From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's a catch-22. If we want to get away from fossil fuels and use more green energy like electric vehicles and solar panels, we need more critical minerals like copper and lithium. And those minerals have to be dug up from mines, which can threaten natural ecosystems, even holy sites, even where we go camping in Idaho. Senior Reuters correspondent Ernest Scheider has been asking the question, what are the choices we're willing to make? In fact, that's the focus of his new book, The War Below, Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives. He's coming to Boise at the invitation of the James A. and Louise McClure Center for Public Policy Research at the University of Idaho to talk about Idaho's minerals and how they fit into this equation. He's going to sit down with leaders from Micron Technology, as well as the Idaho National Laboratory and the Nature Conservancy on October 29th. Ernest is joining us now, along with McClure Center Director, Dr. Catherine Himes. I want to welcome both of you to the program.
Gemma, it's great to be with you.
Thanks so much for having us.
Ernest, let me start with you. Can you give us an idea of what we're talking about when it comes to the growing need for those kinds of minerals that I mentioned?
Sure thing. Well, as we increasingly think about climate change, you know, one way to help fight climate change and carbon emissions is to have more of the everyday parts of our lives powered by batteries, lithium ion batteries, things like electric vehicles, as you were mentioning, wind turbines, solar panels. And that's going to require a lot more critical minerals taken out of the ground than are currently. So we're going to have to vastly increase our production of lithium, copper, cobalt, nickel, and other critical minerals. Right now, the United States does not make many of these critical minerals. They're produced elsewhere in the world. And so therein lies the tension or the rub that I'm exploring with the book.
So, Ernest, how much of a demand then is there right now for those minerals like copper and lithium?
Copper, the demand has been quite high for some time, just given its ubiquity. It's in wiring, of course, it's in pipes, it's in many electronics across the world. Lithium has historically been a rather niche industry. It's been used in greases or pharmacologics. But with the advent of the lithium ion battery a few decades ago and the growing popularity of it, we've seen a huge surge in the past, call it 5 or 10, 15 years with lithium demand. That's only to continue to increase in the coming years. Certainly things like cobalt and nickel are going to continue to increase as well. And there's just not enough being produced right now to sate the demand, not just in the United States, but globally.
Mm-hmm. Catherine, why was it important for you to bring Ernest to Idaho coming up on October 29th, but also pair him up with local industry and conservation leaders?
Yeah, the McClure Center is partnering with Idaho Business for the Outdoors. We really want to have a conversation here in Idaho. We want to bring the conversation here. And we wanted to include perspectives from the Nature Conservancy, from Micron, and from our Idaho National Laboratory. We want to start this conversation, and we plan to continue it through other discussions in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm. So, Ernest, I want to talk about the issue with mining these minerals in places like the Congo. In fact, you've given an example before of 7-year-old children actually mining cobalt. So does this really happen, and how common is this?
Unfortunately, yes, it does happen in certain parts of Africa. The Democratic Republic of the Congo and Zambia have very large copper and cobalt reserves. And while there are established mining companies that operate there, oftentimes you can have families with children and others either break onto mine sites or mine basically the ground nearby in hopes of getting some ore out of the ground. Basically, ore contains these critical minerals, and then they'll sell them into a distribution network where they might get a few bucks for their time. And that cobalt or that copper will then be taken through the global processing network. Now, it can be almost impossible to trace the provenance of that critical mineral back to its source. And when you have children as young as 6 or 7 that can be part of this production chain, I mean, this is backbreaking work. I mean, sometimes kids can be maimed or even killed for this. There's a reason why the safety standards in the United States are quite high if you're going to be a miner. But many of these young children do undertake this task, you know, strictly for economic reasons. You know, it's the way primary way for them to put food on the table. And so there is a huge, obviously, tension point there. And I think we can all agree that we don't want to have child labor be part of our mining supply chain. So it begs the broader question of choice. I mean, that's just one of the tense choices we face as we look at this energy transition. I mean, is this a status quo that we're willing to accept? And if we're not, are there other places that we're willing to think about mining?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that said, when it comes to that choice and thinking about where else we could potentially mine, you point out one of those places could be Idaho. And we're talking in some very, you know, sacred special places in Idaho. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Sure. I think my main goal here when writing the book was to bring this idea of, okay, where do you want to get the building blocks for mm-hmm. the 21st century economy? I wanted to bring that concept to the reader. Idaho is replete with gold, with antimony, with other critical minerals. They're going to be essential, really, for this new electronic economy that's taking shape. So what does it look like to say yes to a mine? What are the standards by which we could allow mining? And who are the people really on all sides of these issues? We're not really, as Americans, as citizens of the world, having these broad conversations right now. And I think that's a mistake. I think we should be having a robust public informed dialogue about whether there are some places too special to mine. What does it look like to allow mining in a certain space? And what are the standards by which we as voters demand our policymakers to enforce? So I really hope the book is part of this broader conversation, because places like Idaho, like Minnesota, like Alaska, like Arizona, they have huge metal deposits in the ground and they're just sitting there right now. So whether or not they should be tapped needs to be part of a broader public conversation. Mm.
So, Catherine, is that part of the reason why you wanted folks from Micron and the INL to also be part of this discussion? Is what Ernest mentioned, right? Is that broader conversation and with stakeholders?
Exactly. I mean, we wanted to bring in the business perspective with Micron and semiconductors. Idaho National Laboratory has a lot of research going on related to critical minerals. And then the Nature Conservancy. And again, these are just three perspectives that are Idaho specific. And we plan to continue conversations to include other perspectives. But we really want an opportunity for Idahoans to engage in this conversation. This is such an important dialogue. And as Ernest said, this is something that really isn't taking place in the United States. And so I think this is an exciting opportunity.
Mm-hmm. So in my introduction, I mentioned things like solar power and electric vehicles, but what about things like cell phones and, you know, maybe even your Alexa, right? Ernest, how is truly our ever-increasing demand for these products driving up the demand for these minerals? Because I don't believe that this demand is going to go away.
You're right there, definitely, Gemma. You know, the number one question I got when I was telling folks that I was writing a book related to critical minerals was, oh gosh, I don't own an electric vehicle, so why should I care about this topic? And indeed, to your point, this is about so much more than electric vehicles. This is about things like the electronic devices in your house, like the microphones, when we're talking to each other right now mm-hmm. through the laptops we use. I even have a chapter in the book about leaf blowers, which might seem sort of whimsy and silly, but I chose that anecdote on purpose because a few years ago I got a house and I decided, since I was writing this book, to go all in on electric lawn care, and I got an electric leaf blower. But that brought me down a bit of a rabbit hole. Okay, if getting an electric leaf blower is better for the environment than having one powered by a two-stroke engine, and I mean it is, the data is quite clear on that. If an electric leaf blower is better, okay, well, where did the critical minerals come from in that leaf blower, which is basically just, you know, this most, you know, the pretty basic household appliance. Mm-hmm. I couldn't figure out where any of the critical minerals came from. Like, where did the copper come from? Did the lithium come from the northern Chilean desert? Did the cobalt get taken out of the ground by a seven-year-old? I had no clue where any of this stuff came from. And I think if you just extrapolate that question across every other electronic gadget and gizmo that we're using every single day, then it really lays bare this tension. Okay, like, where are we actually getting the building blocks, and what standards are they produced? And are children part of that supply chain, or is the land not respected? Was an indigenous holy site dug up? These are things that I think increasingly people need to be thinking through, especially as so many parts of our lives that we touch every single day are going electric.
Well, and Ernest, I mean, you do this research for a living, right? And so if you couldn't figure this out, how in the world is the average person, right, supposed to figure this out?
Right, exactly. The questions of the provenance there, trust me, I tried, Gemma. Like, I have a lot of resources at my disposal in my day job as a journalist covering the critical mineral space, and I couldn't figure it out. So I think for the average person, it just further lays bare that we need to have greater transparency on our supply chains, and perhaps more regional production or closer to home could be an answer to that.
Mm-hmm. So, Ernest, do you think that there needs to be or would have to be a trade-off between environmental impact and mining in order to get these minerals in a way that is safe, that does not allow for child labor, that frankly is a way to do it that is ethical and mindful?
I do think there is a way. You know, I have a chapter in the book that talks about a mining certification program. And before I put your audience to sleep, bear with me. I didn't want the reader to get through the book and just be overwhelmed by the sheer demand projections and the bad reputation in the past that the mining industry had. And so a mining certification program known as IRMA, or the Initiative for Responsible Mining Assurance, was started about 10 or 15 years ago, in part by the jewelry company Tiffany. And of course, it's a jewelry company. They use a lot of critical minerals, gold and silver primarily, and platinum. But they started this IRMA organization with trade groups, with labor unions, with environmental groups and indigenous organizations and investors. And they basically said, what is the best way that we can create mining standards that will be applicable across the planet, and that manufacturers, people that buy the critical minerals from them, would adhere to? And so they actually formed these standards for mining that are slowly gaining traction. And so I tracked the history. I had a great opportunity to talk to the CEO of Tiffany about that for the book and explain to the reader that, hey, like, here are efforts in place to actually make mining standards more codified across countries and to have manufacturers say, this is what we expect when we buy critical minerals. So like if you're building a leaf blower, for instance, you know that the cobalt that came out of the ground was ethically sourced. And so there are efforts underway, and IRMA is one of them, to try to make mining cleaner across the planet.
And Ernest, are there lifestyle and cultural changes that we face in order to really move towards this new kind of green technology? And I ask that because I think it's sometimes very difficult to make significant change. But if you can make small change little by little, sometimes there is significant impact.
Yes. One thing I would definitely encourage folks to think about is, you know, that kitchen drawer you have, just open it up and I'll bet $5 that we all have about 10 old cell phones just sitting in there. And what am I getting at here? I'm getting at recycling. I have a huge meaty chapter in the book about the logistical problems right now with recycling. And so we have so many old just electronics sitting in our homes that could be turned in and the critical mineral is taken out of them and put into new devices. The beauty of the energy transition is that lithium does not lose its ability to retain a charge just because it's been sitting in a battery for 20 years. You can reuse copper over and over again. Same thing with cobalt and nickel, et cetera. Whereas with oil or natural gas, once it's burned off in combustion, it's gone forever and it contributes to climate change. So that's actually a huge positive here, but we've got to actually encourage more and more folks to exercise that muscle and recycle more and more. So that was a key learning as part of my book as well. And I got to talk to two different CEOs of two different recycling companies and look at their ways of trying to encourage more Americans and really folks across the world to think about recycling in a new way.
Catherine, before I let you go, what are you hoping people take away from next week's discussion?
Well, I think that it's complicated. That's very clear when you read Ernest's book. I think it will be very clear from this conversation. But there are also so many opportunities. And so I hope people come bring their neighbors and their colleagues and really begin to understand the complexity as well as the opportunity.
Well, I really appreciate the conversation. So interesting. We've been speaking with senior Reuters correspondent Ernest Schneider, author of the new book, The War Below: Lithium, Copper, and the Global Battle to Power Our Lives, as well as Catherine Himes, director of the James A. and Louise McClure Center for Public Policy Research at the University of Idaho. Schneider will be speaking October 29th at the Egyptian Theater in Boise. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.